gonna take a lot of love to change the way things are. It's gonna take a lot of love.
Kia ora and welcome to the Caravan of Hope, a podcast that brings peace and well-being to all humans on Earth. With me, Brent Caldwell.
And me, COVID O-Matic.
Today is Friday the 16th of March, and we're coming to you from Otipoti, Dunedin, in the South Island of Aotearoa, New Zealand. And it's our very special privilege to be able to welcome Peter Matheson along today. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Brent.
Nice to have you here. I know that you and COVID O are well acquainted, but there'll be maybe a lot of people listening and watching who are interested to hear a wee bit about you, your journey, and your activities, particularly in the field of humanitarianism and peace activism. So I'm going to pass to your good friend here.
Good.
And I'm going to let him fire some questions at you.
So Brent's kind of taken the questions out of my mouth, but we'll start off with, could you tell us about your life and how you got into peace activism and
Well, I come from a long line of Scottish clerics. My father was minister at Knox Church here in Dunedin. His father was a minister. His father was a minister. My mother's father was a minister. So I was doomed. And my father was he was a chaplain in the First World War. Prisoner of war in Italy, escaped from there. He the result of being in the war was he became very close to being a pacifist, and certainly was very involved with the young at that time Iona community, which was an extraordinary set up off the Isle of Mull in Scotland, a tiny wee island, which was the centre of a community which was committed to reviving society and the church by They were socialist in their politics. They were committed. We had all to take a commitment to peacemaking. And it had a very rich Celtic background. So it wasn't a rational sort of community, if you like. It was highly romantic in one way. Enormously rich music with people like the Menuhins involved, and the old stones of the Abbey going back to Benedictine medieval times, they spoke to us too. So it was a mix of people, committed people, and I joined the community as a youngish student in my early 20s.
Okay, thank you. And that's been a big influence in your life. You've been part of that community for...
Yes. And but I was also a young academic, and as part of that, I did my training here in Dunedin in history and loved it. I edited the student, the critic, and was deep into the politics. And we were, as a young, vibrant church group, we were out to change New Zealand. Educationally, socially, so a modest lot of people.
Really. Right, yeah, just the normal student.
And
Peter, can I just interrupt and say we were on the Isle of Mull and now we're in Dunedin. What happened in between?
Well, it's all a bit complicated because I was born in the very north of Scotland, as far away from the English as I could get. And then when Dad went off to the war, we came down to Edinburgh. So I grew up basically in Edinburgh until the age of 13. And then my father was called to be minister at Knox Church, which was then a booming university student church. So I was there from 51 to 60, Brent. And then, having finished my history degree, I decided, to my surprise, I had been, because I was a minister's son, I was automatically an atheist. But I switched by some strange experience and decided I would follow this incredible line of ministers. And so I moved to with the family back to Edinburgh and trained in theology in New College Edinburgh and finished my theology degree and then went over to Germany for 2 years in postgraduate work.
What took you to Germany? What took you to Germany? What was the, it seems like an unusual move from Scotland.
No, there was always very close links between Scotland and Germany theologically. Scotland was more attuned to continental radicalism than England was. So there was a long, long link. And I was able there to study an Italian cardinal. So I already had good German and I now got into Italian and I had good Latin and so on. So I had languages, a bit like Alison last time. And I just fell in love with Germany. And it was a Germany, I was the only English speaker in a group of 200 students.
Wow.
And they were all struggling with their parents' involvement in the Third Reich and so on. So it was an extraordinary liberating experience for me coming from little Scotland in and a fairly protected but liberal church background into this maelstrom of politics that was Germany in the 60s.
Mm. And it would have, I mean, Europe was a very kind of alive place in the student area in the 60s, particularly late 60s.
It was beginning to be, it was the Wirtschaftswunder, it was Erhard, we will rebuild, and they did rebuild incredibly. But there was very little awareness of anything beyond making your way in the world. So the group I was in just happened by pure luck to be founded by the Confessing Church, which had been one of the few opponents to Hitler in the Third Reich. So it was an unusual group. I just landed lucky, really. And I came across Hans Kuhn. Do you know that name? He was the leading figure in Vatican II, opening up Catholicism. So I went to his seminars, and as so I was really opened up to Third Reich history. The students would invite me home to their place and tackle their parents. What the hell did you do in the Third Reich when I was there as a lightning conductor, you know? It was, so it was a very formative time for me, and I really Germanized. I dreamt in German, I lived German, and I married a German. So
that's the whole package, isn't it, really?
So that, Brent, is filling in the gaps.
Yeah, okay. So when I listen to you talk and I hear your your upbringing, your experiences and your education, I kind of think that was a pretty tumultuous time, a very unique time.
Yeah.
Like you, my father was a serviceman. He fought in Africa and Libya and COVID O's as well. Yeah. So our parents were dealing with a world that was focused on peace.
Yeah.
And rebuilding. And as you say, younger generations questioning what's going on. I mean, you know, it's interesting to hear about the German experience because we're inculcated into the Vietnam experience. And the protests around going to war in Korea, going to war in Vietnam. Yeah. And of course, New Zealand had involvement in those.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, with your work and with your study, what was your position in terms of what you wanted for mankind and humanity?
Well, I had very little concern for mankind and humanity at that point. I wanted to make a career. That's probably unfair to myself, but I got this extraordinary offer of becoming a lecturer in New College, which was just the premier college for theology in Scotland, and it was, you know, a young lecturer. I was just with a young family. I was just absolutely flat out preparing lectures, and I loved teaching. There's something about getting a first year class, these enthusiastic innocents, and getting into it, and something about moving to the more senior. I did a lot of work on group dynamics and teaching and so on, and began, instead of getting the students to do essays, I got them to instead drama, to prepare dramas on the period. Wow. And so I was really, what I'm saying, Brent, I was really primarily an academic, but at the same time, Hank and my wife and myself, we were quite involved in Parents for Survival, because it was the time when the nuclear threat, Reagan's madness, Star Wars, all the rest of it, was at its height. So I got very involved. We did, both of us, very involved in marches and protests in Scotland. And I think I really tasted despair for the first time deeply through that. Helen Caldicott, to that name.
Yeah.
The
CND campaign.
Yes, but it was broader than CND because for me there was the religious dimension to it, and the utter disgust I felt at the way in which Christianity was being used to sanctify. I remember my dad saying, he was a very high-ranking cleric at the time, and he was called upon to bless a nuclear submarine, you know? And his mate, George MacLeod, said, "Och, Jim, it's okay as long as you don't breathe in." There was this struggle, both what the hell do I really believe in my faith when my church is so compromised, and I founded something with others. The Great General Assembly was the main gathering of the Scottish Church at the time, once a year. And so we founded a dissembly, and to shoot, it was quite aggressive, I think. So I was a bit of an aggressive young pacifist, I suppose. quite distasteful. You know, radicals are hard to get on with.
Mm. And at that time, were you connected with the Iona community?
Yes, George MacLeod, who was the leader. Yes, yes, very much so.
But would it be fair to say, Peter, that at that time, that kind of firebrand activism was the type of thing that would generate interest in the media and get coverage and bring more attention to those types of activities. We had our own sort of issues with the Springbok tour in 1981. Yeah. When I think of CND, I think of Greenham Common and the women camping out there and people power just being flexed. Yes. And I wouldn't beat yourself up because I was saying...
No, I know.
Think in that period, that was the accepted way of being an activist.
Yeah, well, I think rage has its place. Just there was something about the hypocrisy of society and the church that got me going. But then quite a change took place because after 10 years teaching in, no, it was 15 years teaching in New College, Edinburgh, I got this chance out of the blue to come back to Dunedin to be Professor of Church History here. And part of the game was for the first time I had to get ordained as a minister. So it was a move both back to my Kiwi roots and to my religious roots in a way. So my life became a bit more spiritual. And one of the interesting things, Brent, is that we got very involved with the anarchist group in Edinburgh, in Dunedin, that was running the nascent peace movement in the 1980s. And it would, you'll remember, it was tiny wee group at that time of scattered pacifists, CND, and so on. But they had skills in terms of publicity, and they acted as an interesting sort of umbrella group. So they didn't push an ideological line. They encouraged research into peace. They encouraged action. They were open to feminist concerns. So there was a broadening of our understanding of what peace involved and peace and justice. And the whole Pacific dimension was very important because a lot of the folk in that early peace movement, the Maori Women's Welfare League was very strong, the Pacific dimension, Corso and so on, was very strong in Dunedin. So that all began to really burgeon. And we did I suppose, Brent, you're into drama a big way, I know, but one of the things we discovered was the importance of doing open-air drama in the Octagon and so on to try and get across to folk what we were on about.
Mm.
So talking doesn't hack it. To change my big passion is how do you change yourself and others? And it's partly the spiritual thing, partly the dramatic thing, and I think partly the humor thing. I've a nasty sort of, you know, that sense of humor.
Yeah, I enjoy it.
Okay.
I think it's essential, actually, for us in any line of work, actually, humor, just living. If you've got humor, it's
Yeah, and it can help offset things. So I'm going to take a real jump into today.
Yep.
And say, you know, like you say, talking doesn't hack it.
No.
We've seen in the United Nations there's an awful lot of talking, and it's not hacking it. This podcast grew out of despair. You mentioned despair earlier, and I thought that's kind of why we were thinking about starting this podcast. If you could wave your magic wand or pull some levers and make some things happen in terms of what would be effective for bringing greater focus, more pressure, exerting influence, given what you've said about drama and protesting and those things, what steps do you think we could take here in New Zealand or in the wider world to effect some kind of change?
These are huge questions, and in some ways, obviously, we three of us here are here because we're about hope. My experience is that hope is a menacing thing to people. They prefer to trot along on their traditional trajectories. And to suggest that we need, as I believe we do environmentally and all the rest of it, quite a different way of looking at how we use our time. I am outraged at the way my friends jump into planes at the drop of a hat for trips all over Europe and so on. So it's hope. If you're really hopeful about a different future, it threatens the quotidian experience of normal people. And I live in a very suburban environment, and almost no one in Maori Hill understands. Well, I don't know. So your question is, how do we get through to them? And partly it's a very modest thing that my wife and I are doing at the moment. We're getting as close as we can to the Ukrainian community, which, as you know, meets every Saturday at the Octagon, and is a wee sort of mini university in a way, raising questions which are largely academic universities not raising. It's interesting, one of the key members of the group is a bus driver who says, why is the university not the critic and the conscience of society? So getting close, helping sounds is the wrong word, but we meet every evening with, not every evening, once a week with some of the Ukrainians and help them with their English and so on. But it's you know, you stand in the middle of the Octagon and wave the flags, and occasionally there's bagpipers and singers and so on. But it's not really getting through. And I don't know how you get through. Yeah, I think it's a much more difficult time to get across to folk the need for radical change than it was when I kicked off in 50 years ago. That right?
I don't know. I'm not exactly sure about that answer to that question. But I was going to say, one thing I think is actually, I know that you and Heinke go every week to the support the Ukrainians, and I think that's huge. I mean, coming back to a previous talk we had with Alison Phipps, where she was saying it actually happens at the dinner table.
Where
we eat together, we greet, we meet.
Yeah.
And I think the change is going to come by those little incremental things. But also, I think that what's happened because of the extraordinary, terrific, not terrifying, genocide we see on the TV in Gaza.
Yes, that's right.
It has actually motivated people in a way which I've never experienced across the world.
Yes, yes.
People are actually out there, and people are realizing all over the world that our governments are not actually representing us. I'm not sure what they're doing, but you know, I would imagine if you took a poll, 90% of New Zealanders would want to cease fire in Gaza. You know, similar in England and Scotland, but the governments are amazingly reluctant to actually say we need a ceasefire.
Yes, but they want that, but they do bugger all about it. I mean, that's my problem. People are concerned and they watch on TV and so on, but they go on with their lives as it was. And how do you get through that? And part of my belief about this is individually people will not move. So you have to create communities of concern. I happen to be very lucky to be in a church congregation which is about to join. Let me explain that. In the Second World War, Coventry was blasted to bits by German bombs. And Dresden was blasted to bits by British bombs. And one of the most extraordinary things is that from Coventry, a movement began, a community of the cross, they called it, which instead of just accepting this is what it is, began to build bridges. Paula Streicher, who was a high school student here in Dunedin, ex from Germany, his parents Jewish and so on. He became dean of Coventry Cathedral, and he had fluent German. So he went over, he's still alive in his 90s, he went over dozens of times to Germany. So something incredible happened of a friendship, a solidarity, healing the wounds of the nations. big words. But it actually happened. And this community now has people in South Africa, congregations, theological colleges in Bavaria, in Canada, in England, of course. And our congregation is about to join up with it, with various commitments to the healing of the nations as part of our core business. So part of the thing that chugs me along is a sense that it's one of the reasons I think, Brent, that COVIDO and I are close, is that unless you start with yourself and where you are, you cannot convert your desire for change into action. So that's all sounds a bit pretentious, but
it's a bit like that Gandhi expression, you know, be the change you want to see.
Yeah.
So we've talked about an action of governments. We've talked about individual actions in the Octagon in Dunedin.
Yes.
Where to from here for the people of Gaza, or for the next conflict? Something that struck me as you were speaking was you were talking about the system as it is now with governments locked in.
Yeah.
And COVID, you were saying that our governments don't seem to be representing us. And our whole way of sharing information is quite siloed and compartmented. You know, you think of what's happening in Gaza, it might get, I don't know, 120 seconds on the news.
Yes.
And that's all we've got time for.
Yes.
And Ukraine gets virtually nothing now.
Yeah, because it's almost like, well, Ukraine is an established fact, it's a situation, and we'll come back to you when there's a winner.
Or when it gets interesting. When there's a really gory mess.
Yeah.
We are so visual that nothing happens. It's the head-heart stuff that's not working, the combination of these two.
But do you think there's an expectation that things can be fixed quickly? Because, you know, you've just said it. It's going to take lots of talk. It's going to take lots of understanding, lots of meeting of minds. That stuff doesn't happen in 5 minutes.
And what behind all that is the lies, the forests and forests of lies, the polite. I mean, I've really, we as a family have been very, my shelves are full of Jewish books. I have Hebrew. I have some Yiddish. Heinke sings Yiddish songs. We have a dear Israeli friend in our kibbutz. But what really tears us up is the soul, as we understand it, of Judaism. Is wonderful inheritance of this. We see in the psalmists and the prophets and the whole Martin Bubers and all the rest of it. It's betrayed. And so what do you do about lies? How do you get people, you know, they're saying they're going to open a humanitarian section in Gaza to shunt the folk from Rafah up. And we know 1.5 million people can't be moved like a flock of sheep. And the sheer brutality and inhumanity, but it's all covered over with smooth lies. And why do the Bidens of this world swallow these lies? Good people.
Yeah, did you read Gwyn Dyer's article in the ADT yesterday?
Yeah.
I think he'd had enough of sort of lip service.
Yes.
And was saying that, you know, that they're calling it the Pier of Hope. That they're going to build, that the Navy bees are going to build, and you know, he's just calling it out and saying, well, don't be ridiculous, you could solve this thing in 5 minutes.
Yes.
If you bring pressure to bear on the people who are closing those borders.
Yes, of course.
Netanyahu government.
Yeah.
I don't know much about anything political, but I've traveled a bit, I've seen what I consider to be how big operations work, and to me it seems that Gaza is the casualty of a longer game of world politics.
Oh,
and they
absolutely
are completely expendable.
Yeah.
And good people wring their hands and say, what can I do? People in power think, well, it's a bit of a collateral cost, but you know, it's a means to an end. And how do we get people out of that mindset of it's okay because it's 30,000 people who aren't living here?
I think that's particularly hard for us in Kiwiland. I'm interested that quite a lot of the folk who are closest to the Palestinian cause are Maori, who have experienced colonization and oppression. One of the really difficult things, I think, I keep shutting my eyes when I should be talking to you. one of the difficult things is that people talk, but they don't actually engage with one another, and they haven't been through it. I mean, I've been lucky in a way, and I think all of us have been lucky in that we've crossed boundaries, all sorts of boundaries, cultural and spiritual and so on. But a lot of people live in their so-called villages, in their suburban silos. And so I think unless people almost physically, certainly metaphorically, move out of their comfort zone, you're not going to get any change.
I wanted to ask you, going on a different tack, was I know that you wrote a book about a German woman.
Yes,
whose name is
Agla von Grumbach.
Yes, yes.
And sort of just wondering, like, why you wrote this book about her and maybe what she has to teach us about what's happening
that
now.
That is interesting. I mean, here we have an aristocrat, a Bavarian aristocrat, we're talking about the 1520s, and who lived in a world where women did what they were told, more or less, even aristocratic women. By pure chance, I'm a Reformation historian, but I, for 30 years, I never heard of her. And then I came across a microfiche with material from other reformers. And there was this poem, very stuffy poem, stuffy, I mean, by strong poem, by this woman. I thought, who is this? And I dropped everything else, found that she'd written seven other pamphlets which challenged every authority in the time, that challenged the professors in the university to debate with her. Unheard of, unheard of for a woman. She challenged her prince, she challenged her husband, because she was just outraged at, it began with a student friend who had to go through a show trial and give up his views or get barbecued. And
what do you mean by barbecued?
Martyred.
Oh, martyred, okay, yes. So it wasn't sort of like just excommunicated. It was,
No, it was the real thing. And she just thought, how can people who claim to be followers of Christ use violence against, did Jesus go around torturing and imprisoning people, you know? So it, in a sense, very simple stuff, but one of my biggest convictions is that until you get elemental, until you get away from the crap, from the talk, from the pieties, to realities, nothing will ever change. And so she wrote, she is the first woman in German history to be published in her lifetime.
Wow.
Wow. You know, and by pure chance, I stumbled on her and translated all her stuff, wrote her biography, blah, blah, blah. But it was quite inspiring. And I better complete this by saying that the other 10 years of work that I put in was to a peasant leader in the Peasants' War, which no one knows about in New Zealand, but it's the biggest thing before the French Revolution, 1524-5. Ordinary peasants, miners, rose up in their tens of thousands and took on the system. And this guy, Thomas Münzer, was one of their leaders. He was also a mystic, and his German is atrociously difficult, but I spent 10 years and I immersed it and became him, sort of. So in a way, history is identification with people in their lives. And maybe that's the way through. I mean, Munzer said, look at our princes. If someone pinches a rabbit, they get the chopper. Whereas the amount of structural violence, of course, he didn't use terms like these, they do is nobody's business. So those who are supposed to be ensuring the justice systems, the educational systems, they're all frauds. And he saw Luther, the great leader, as just becoming another sort of pope, another defender of the system. So he got the chopper, of course. He got imprisoned and tortured. But there's a sort of red line, isn't there, the Martin Luther Kings and so on. Everyone who sticks their neck out knows what's going to descend on it.
So I could see those people would be people that you actually, you are actually doing their work now. You're talking out against these authorities. Yes.
So the academic is not different from the political, it's not different from the spiritual. We have to get our act together as human beings, yeah. I think.
When you speak about that, I'm mindful. You know, this week is the anniversary of the terror attacks in Christchurch, and our Prime Minister then, Jacinda Ardern, was lauded around the world because of the humanity that she showed towards the victims of that crisis. And you know, obviously, lots of people like to cut that down and sort of say, well, that's just being cute for politics. But I think whose example should we be following in terms of addressing the current situation? You know, you say that von Grumbach, you know, she took on the system, she wrote stuff. Martin Luther King stuck his neck out, Bobby Kennedy, Indira Gandhi, you know, they upset people with their actions.
Yes.
I'm not saying these people are saints, but there is a risk at sticking your neck out.
Yes.
But people are always looking for some example. I mean, Jesus Christ, the Buddha, you know, Muhammad are all examples of people that we can follow.
Yes.
But there are so many voices at the moment, and lying, as you've said, has now become a tactic for the disinformation and watering down any messages of truth. So whose example should we look to?
Especially in this country, it's hard, isn't it? You look round for the Mandelas here and so on, and it doesn't jump out at you, anyone in particular. I just yesterday I got an email from Glyn Cardy, who's the minister of the most radical church in Auckland, and he had rediscovered the old cross that had been carried out in the Springbok tour, and then had gone round the whole country. There are folk like Glyn Cardy around. I have a lot of time for the green politicians, many of whom are paying quite a price for what they're doing, because it's not just a game for them. But the leadership thing, it is so crucial, isn't it? I mean, it's so desperate that Israel has no leaders at the moment to take it out of that. The Palestinians have no leaders, or they haven't emerged yet anyway. To some extent, Zelensky has been a good leader for the Ukrainians. But who in New Zealand? I think that's the question. And is it maybe the case that at the moment, in the interim, we don't look round for some Führer, but that we use the resources we have, the people we trust who talk from the heart and the mind. Patman, I think, who you've been interviewing, does a superb job. Look at Alison Phipps, who you were interviewing last time. So there are folk around, but I think we have to build community and this business I keep coming back to, that we have to generate some hope. I think it really is quite scary that a lot of the young folk I meet don't see any future for themselves. Mm. And so...
Is that in relation to the climate or in relation to the politics?
The climate and the politics, and they've no time for the institutional churches and... Mm. So I think broadening, deepening our understanding of hope, I think is crucial. It's a tough business. It's hope against hope. Mm. It's a sort of defiance, isn't it, of what we see around us. So good on you with this caravan of hope. I think you're on the right lines. And let's see what we can do in terms of raising folks' horizons.
Thank you very much, Kavito. It's probably time for us to wrap things up now. Do you have any closing comments or anything that you want to say?
No, just to say thank you very much, Peter.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's always lovely to be with you and hear your viewpoints, because you've got a huge experience there across many areas.
Yeah. Well, two of you have also. Yep, good.
Lovely. So that's it for the Caravan of Hope from this particular episode. obviously, thank you to Peter Matheson for coming in and sharing your wealth of knowledge. And I've probably got more questions as a result of this conversation. So who knows, we may get you back another time. But from me, Brent Caldwell.
And me, COVID O'Matic.
May you be well. May you be happy. May you live with ease.
And may all beings live in peace.
Good.
Bye now.
Take a lot of